Session number 16808, Reel 1.
Reg Spittles, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
Northampton, in 27th of August, 1918.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in Northampton?
Yes, I actually only went to one school at all. That was Kingsthorpe Grove, which was about half a mile from where I lived. We had a school at the top of the street, but my mother thought the Kingsthorpe Grove school was a better education. So she insisted I went to there, which was rather unusual because most lads went to the nearest school, which I say was about 300 yards from where I lived. I went there at 5 and came out at 14, considered to be the finished product.
So in 32, did you get a job?
Yes, the usual thing in Northampton, which was a boot and shoe town. 90% of everybody were in the factories, boot and shoe factories. And I naturally went in the boot and shoe factory, and that was in the clicking room at Crockett's and Jones in Perry Street, Northampton. Which is still in operation, actually.
Were you in boots and shoes when war was declared?
Yes, I was in the clicking room still at 21. I was 21, August the 27th. And we was called up that week because I was in the Territorial Army prior to the war. And then, of course, we were all ready up the drill for the September the 3rd when the war started.
Can you tell me about joining TA before the war?
Well, I was in the 2nd Northamptonshire Yeomanry originally. We had two regiments of yeomen, Northamptonshire Yeomanry. One was naturally the 1st and the 2nd. Well, in 1938, when the first, what you might call panic, came on of possibility of a Second World War, they started the yeomanry up from cold storage, and previous to that it had been the 25th Armoured Car Company allied to the Royal Tank Corps, which was only about 120 men. So they put that in cold storage, took out the yeomanry, which immediately got an influx and made a regiment of 650 men. Well, in 1939, again, there was more chances of a war, and they decided to start a second regiment. And so in April of the 1939, they had another campaign of people to join up, and along with hundreds of other lads, I joined up. And so started the 2nd Northamptonshire Yeomanry. And that immediately gave the government another 650 people to get part trained ready for the war, which happened in September. And of course, what we did, we used to go up two nights a week doing drills, as they called it, which meant that what bit of equipment they got, you shared out on different nights with other classes, as it was, basically. And by the time the war started, I mean, you knew what a rifle was, you knew what a revolver was, you knew what Vickers machine guns were. We got a 2-pounder on a riper up in the target room where we used to have simulated firings with a 2-2 pellet gun allied to the 2-pounder. And so with the sand table, you were firing through the telescopic sighting. Although you were only sort of 30 yards away, you were sort of firing at 1,000 yards, 1,100 yards. Because it was simulated, you see. And all you fired actually was the 2-2 pellet, but the crew were actually loading up with dummy 2-pounder shells, rubber ones, you see. So by the time we got Valentine tanks in 1941, which had 2-pounders in, we were conversant with that weapon without having to go any fresh training, you know, to a training regiment or anything. And of course, all we had were a few lorries, two or three armoured cars, Rolls Royce and Lanchesters. And when the wars came on, of course, they had to commandeer such vehicles as they required to make us a sort of a mobile unit. But basically, having no units when the war started, we were used for doing guard duties on whatever they chose to be sort of sufficiently needed military guards. One of them locally was the depot at Weedon, where they had a big ordnance depot, and which is adjacent to the canal, you see, which apparently, well, it was built for that purpose because all the ammunition was brought up on the canal in the old days. And we used to supply a guard there. We used to have a squadron at a time doing the guards, And we used to do eight hours on, 16 off, 1 week, and then you change shifts. So you did along 3 weeks, 8 hour different shifts, you see. Another one we did was Witten Aerodrome. The first regiment were doing Wittering Aerodrome. The second regiment was doing Witten Aerodrome down near Huntingdon. And again, we used to supply a squadron purposely to do the night guards for the aerodrome, which caused a little bit of, not aggravation, but a bit of fun, I suppose, because we all made out that the RAF were frightened of the dark, you see, because we only used to do the night guards. We did find out one thing useful, because when the war came on, strangely enough, Brill Cream disappeared and you couldn't buy it anymore. And it was retained purposely for the RAF. And the only place you could buy Brill Cream during the war was in the RAF canteens. So when we got down there, that was one advantage. We were able to purchase jars of Brill Cream again, instead of Brilliantine, which was like sort of Vaseline, really. So, you know, that was a little bit of a perk.
Did
but of
you
course,
use it?
From oh, everybody used Brill Cream. It was the old short back insides and Brill Cream, and you was away. But of course, it was almost immediately after the war started. It wasn't above a couple of months, and we started having the drafts out to the Middle East and places like that. And of course, they had a purge, a medical purge, because a person that was considered probably fit peacetime for a TA mob wouldn't necessarily be A1 for wartime, you see. So immediately we started having medicals, and blokes who were sort of downgraded, and they just disappeared from the regiment to be replaced gradually from training regiments. But initially what we did get was a big influx from the 5th and 4th Yeomanry and the middle and the Lothian Borderers, because apparently their regiments had gone to France, and the younger ones, they were still exercising the peacetime protocol, which was if you were 18, you could not go overseas, you see. So all our chaps who we lost through medical reasons and drafts out to the Middle East, slowly reducing us, were replaced with all these young chaps from the Scotland, from the 5th and 4th and Lothian Borderers, you see. And in fact, on one of the photos of Sea Squadron, when you look, you can sort of see half of them are yeomen and half of them are Scotch lads, like, you know. But they mixed in, you know, and gradually, as the war went on, with drafts becoming more prominent out, and then training regiments got going, and we were having them direct from training regiments, and of course these were young chaps, and as the war went on, the initial original terriers became thinner on the ground. By the time we went to Normandy, which was like where we went in action, we never saw any action until Normandy. Both regiments were the same. And my squadron photograph, there is only about 20 of the original 1939 TA chaps like myself who were left, and all the rest were either the remnants of these Scotch lads and these training regiment lads. And of course, we did at different times have intakes from the infantry. And one of them was the Norfolk Regiment, Royal Norfolks, and which I didn't know they were Royal until one day our Sergeant Major, one of the lads who was in our troop, young, he came from Cherry Hinton, Cliff Pullum, and he was a proper country boy. And one day the Sergeant Major said to him, "Where do you come from?" You see, because we'd had these influx from training regiments, from infantry regiments and training regiments, and he was curious to know where they'd actually come from, you see. So he said, "Where did you come?" So he said, "I come from the Norfolk, sir." So he said, "The what?" He said, "The Norfolk, sir." He said, "If you say that again, you'll be on a charge. Now, where did you come from?" "The Royal Norfolk, sir." They'd forgot to put the Royal on, you see, and the Sergeant Major was onto that. But the war progressed, you know, and these things happened. And then we spent the first Christmas, our squadron, down at Witten Aerodrome. Well, then the other two squadrons, well, the three squadrons, HQ, were at Wootton. They just out of town, a village out of town. And B squadron at Brixworth, which is, again, is 5 or 6 miles out of town. C Squadron were at Gillsborough, which is, again, about 5 or 6 miles out of town. And, of course, Dunkirk was threatening. And what they did, the two regiments, three regiments of the brigade, we were by now known to be the 20th Armoured Brigade, which comprised of the 1st and 2nd Northamptonshire Yeomanry and the Royal Gloucester Hussars. And of course we had our own brigade HQ, you see. Well, what they did, I don't think this was just us, I think it happened to other brigades or divisions. We were asked to supply three squadrons, X, Y and Z. And brigade supplied the RHQ for that those three squadrons, you see. So our regiment, the 2nd Yeomanry, we provided Z Squadron. They took all the equipment we'd got, which was just about enough for a squadron, and between the whole brigade, we formed one regiment. We went down to, in our case, Z Squadron, we went into Moulton Paddocks at Newmarket, a racing stables, and Major Dollar became our major in charge of the squadron, and we were actually there when Dunkirk happened. I understand from reading of books since that the intention was, and I believe this did actually happen to other formations, that we were to be put in to sort of act as a buffer to allow the evacuation, which was more or less going to happen, as a sort of a stumbling block while they got up as many people as they could. Luckily for us, Dunkirk happened before, while we were still at Newmarket, you see. So then the whole, what was left of the division as a whole, we became part of the 1st Armoured Division, our brigade, and the whole lot moved down to East Anglia, and then my squadron, original squadron, A Squadron, which I was of the 2nd Yeomanry, we were in a village and the hall and the drive up to this place of, what was that? It's near Sudbury, it was actually, and they usually had the big houses, which they took over, you know, local big houses, and we were in the drive of this big house near Sudbury, A Squadron, and then we started to get Guy Armoured cars, and what used to happen, there'd be a message come through, and from Chilwell, Nottingham, and they would say they got so many armoured cars become available, you see. And we would send up a truck with sufficient people to, just two people to a car. I mean, there's only three in it anyway, but all you needed was a driver and somebody in the turret, you see, to bring it back to Sudbury there from Chilwell, you see. And I went up on one trip because it didn't matter who was available, as long as there was a driver and somebody to stick in the turret. But over a period of time, this squadron was equipped totally with Guy Armoured cars, because they were not armoured as regards weapons. All we collected was a car. And then the guns came in from somewhere else, and we had the job of cleaning them up, and then the armourers fitted them and T&A'd them, and gradually the armoured cars became equipped with a big Beezer and a small Beezer machine guns. And we carried on with those all through that summer of 1940, which was the Battle of Britain. And of course it was a glorious summer, and as I've said to people who have talked to me before about it, it was really like a summer of butlins on wheels, because we obviously not fighting anybody, and what all we did was exercises with the local Home Guards, our own exercises for whatever purpose they were supposed to be for, in imaginary enemy, or in lots of times I've thought since the war, it wasn't so much what they thought we could do as a fighting force, but administratively how quickly they could get us from one point to another to be useful. That's the impression I've had since the war, because at the time you think you're there for the purpose of fighting, you know, but which you were, but the thing is, if the organisation couldn't get you to the right place in the right time, then you were useless, you see. And so we used to do that. We used to do exercises, 48 hours, 72 hours, never very long, you see, because they were always expecting an invasion. And so they didn't want you to be away on, say, a month's exercise, totally out of contact and not able to be got at, you see. So we used to do 48 hours or 72 hour exercises, and which were never above divisional strength. And apart from that, we would go around collecting German air crews that had come down from bombers or something, and some irate farmer had got them pinned up against the wall with a pitchfork or something, you see. And we used to go around collecting these crews up and hand them over to the Red Caps and that sort of thing. But it was a wonderful summer, and as I say, it was more like a picnic really, because there was no problem of fighting anybody. And then when the winter came, when the end of the year came, we went into winter quarters at Westbury in Wiltshire. That was the second yeomanry. The first yeomanry went into Trowbridge, and where the Glossers went I couldn't tell you, because we were the same town regiments, you know, we seem to know more about where the first and second were rather than where the Gloucesters were. But that winter of 1940, the first yeomanry went into Trowbridge, the second went into Westbury, and again the squadrons were dispersed out to different local areas. And in the case of our squadron, we went to a village of Dilton, which at that time was probably 2 miles out of Westbury. I suppose now it's been absorbed into Westbury. And again, they took over these large country houses, and that became your squadron headquarters, you see. We went into a house called Boyer's House, which was obviously a derelict property. They hadn't sort of asked the family to move out so we could move in. So the house was obviously derelict before we occupied it, and it was very sparse. If they used it for a prisoner war camp there, they'd have complained, you know, the condition it was. And so we went into Westbury House, into Boyer's House for the winter, and made it as comfortable as we could. The armoured cars disappeared, we lost those, so all we got left with our lorry transport. And then we started doing schools through the winter on Valentine tanks, 2-pounders, 19 wireless sets and all that sort of thing. All the new equipment that we hadn't had previously, because from obviously 1941 we were going to be a tank regiment rather than an armoured car regiment, you see. And of course when 1941 came, we came out of hibernation as it were, and they took us on a train and they took us down to Cambridge. And it was rather funny because we used to listen to Lord Haw Haw on the wireless, and it was a joke, you see. And I mean, lots of the stuff he said was ridiculous, but strangely enough, there was sometimes a little element of truth used to come out of it. And when we moved from Westbury to Cambridge, Lord Haw said that the 20th Armoured Brigade would be moving to their east of England for their summer's training with their new vehicles. And it was true, we were going to. And I'm thinking about the only time we ever heard the truth, but it was strange. And he said that they will be welcomed by our Luftwaffe. And strangely enough, when we were unloading at Cambridge, they had their first incendiary bomb dump of the war. And they had the sirens going, and we were still on the railway when the air raids went.
On Cambridge Railway
Station. On Cambridge Railway Station. And to get the train, the tanks off, they still had to get them off, you see. I issued each commander, so I was a driver then, my commander, still alive actually, Fred Tilley, lives down in St James. I was driving him, he was my sergeant, troop sergeant, and I was his driver, I was a trooper naturally. And he didn't smoke, and they issued it out with the cigarettes, you see, 2 cigarettes to each commander if he didn't smoke. And the idea was that in the dark he would sort of keep them illuminated and guide you right hand or left arm with the glow from the cigarettes, you see. And the next morning, poor Alfred couldn't speak, he'd croaking because he didn't smoke, and keeping those cigarettes going, he had a sore throat, he couldn't speak. Anyway, that's how they got us off, using the cigarettes indicating left and right, or come on, you know, as we used to. And eventually got us off the railway, you see. And there was another funny thing happened, because roundabouts were unheard of in those days, as they're not now, you see. And of course, it was simply a soil roundabout in Cambridge. And we went up to Cherry Hinton, up the Cherry Hinton Road, you see. And there was this roundabout. Well, of course, there was a blackout and it was a dark night. And the lights and everything were subdued and all that. So we were driving up the road to Cherry Hinton. And suddenly we came to a place where there was a dip. You sort of went down and came up again. And what we found out afterwards had happened, that with these Valentine tanks, which you've got battle tracks on, I mean, they used to rip roads to pieces, tarmac roads. And what had happened, there was this roundabout which the first tanks had gone across. The whole squadron followed, but instead of being an over-the-top roundabout, it had become an underground almost roundabout, and sort of totally destroyed it, you see. But we went up to, as I say, up to the Cherry Hinton Road, and then over the next few months and that, they spread us out into the various villages, like Wilbraham and people like that, you see. And we saw it was slowly getting organised with the realisation that there was a war on, you see. And it was all taking very time and trouble, like. And two squadrons of ours, I believe it was B squadron, we finished up in the drive of the big house from this village, Stoke Quay, which is sort of outside of Cambridge, on the way to Newmarket. I think now there's a big, major, big roundabout complex there. But at that time, it was simply a country road that went up by Marshall's Aerodrome at that time, which was, again, a small, very small affair. And we went past that, and you came to this village of Stoke Quay. Well, you didn't see the village because that stood back from the road. And as you turned off the road to the left to go to the village, you went round a severe S-bend, and on the right stood the church, and the village was further down the road, you see. And on the left was the drive down to the big house, where we had our two squadrons, A squadron of the 2nd Yeomanry, and I believe it was B squadron. And we were in the drive. Well, B squadron were at the top, and we were at the bottom. And all down the left-hand side, at the top of the drive, there was the normal lodge, where the lodge, because it was like still peacetime atmosphere. I mean, the lodge keeper still lived there with his family and all that, you see. And there was an orchard down the side, on that side, for a quarter reasonable distance down the drive, you see. Well, obviously, putting troops in, he realised that they weren't going to get no fruit, you see, because service people are natural thieves by nature. And so what they did, they arranged with the two squadron leaders that they would allocate certain trees, apple, plum, pear, to the squadrons, that they must not touch the orchard. That when that fruit was ready on those designated trees, it would be picked and we would have them. And that was the arrangement. I don't know whether it worked out or not, I'm sure, because we were at the bottom and so we didn't sit. The orchard was up alongside a B squadron. Whether they honoured the contract, I don't know. But when we were at Wootton Hall, just outside Northampton, which is now the police station at Mere Way, and they occupy it now, the county police have got it. But when we was there, the family had moved out to another residence and vacated it, you see. And the whole of the banisters and everything were boarded in with plywood to stop people carving the names everywhere, you see. And there were orchards there, and they could never make it out. They never, the tomatoes never seemed to ripen up to red. Because every night prowler guard, if they saw a red tomato, they picked it naturally. So, you know, we were natural thieves, service people. And I don't want to digress too much, but anyway, we were in 1940 initially down the drive of this big house at Stoke-on-Quai, two squadrons of the 2nd Yeomanry, and they used to take us out on what we first had were the first transporters, and they used to take us out to Thetford Heath with these Valentines to do a bit of training, you see. And at that time we were getting more daring and we were getting more organised, and we now belonged to the first Armoured Division, which in those days comprised of two armoured brigades. I can't tell you what the other brigade's number was, but we were the 20th, you see. And an armoured division at that time was rather a cumbersome thing, and I don't think it happened until they went to North Africa, and by then we were in the 6th Armoured Brigade. That was the male fist, and it was the 6th Armoured Brigade Division, I should say, the 6th Armoured Division that went to North Africa, you see, on Torch. And at that time they had still had two armoured brigades to a division, and they decided to take one brigade out totally and in effect cut the armoured division formation as it was then in half. More or less they could make two divisions from one division. I think what they'd learned, the lesson was from the Russians, that it was better to have smaller divisions and more in number, and they were more versatile and efficient. And that's when we started to have one armoured brigade to a division, previously having two armoured brigade to a division, and which was rather cumbersome, as you can imagine. But anyway, we did this summer of 1940 with the 1st Armoured Division, and they used to take us out to Thetford Heath, and they got these rather what I call mucked up transporters, because you couldn't, we hadn't got the facilities to suddenly appear efficient with every sort of item of equipment we needed. So we were sort of making do, if you get my meaning, with equipment that wasn't the proper equipment. They made do, and they got these big lorries, which to me appeared to be just a normal 10-ton vehicle, and so the platform of the vehicle was very high. I mean, later on we had real transporters, and of course the platform was very low to the ground, the wheels were lower and all that sort of thing, you see. But initially they had these like ordinary, what appeared to me, 10-ton lorries, just took the back off and left the platform on, and I suppose they must have reinforced the spring in, and then they had these ramps, big ramps, which you wound up and wound down, and they went up in two halves, sort of like a describe it really so you can understand on the speaking, but it came up in like two halves, joined together of course, and as you wound them down, the cable came out and released them, you see, because they normally travelled upright. And so if there was any low telephone wires, of course they just took them with them. And they lowered those, and the height from the platform was quite high from the ground. And the commander, who was guiding the tank car, and they were only very narrow, the tracks were. They weren't wide, they were not much wider than the tank tracks themselves, so they're very tricky. And they had to make sure that they were the right width, and you drive the tank up. And fortunately, in a Valentine, the driver sat in the centre. It wasn't sitting offset one side or the other as we did in later tanks. We were sitting in a Valentine, same as the armoured cars. You were sat dead in the centre of the vehicle, which helped. And so when you came up, you drove up, and you were quite good at judging. And the commander would stand on the back of the lorry, on the lorry, so initially you could look up and see him. Because in a Valentine, the driver's doors were on either side. He couldn't have a door over his head to look out, so he used to lean forward and peer through his visor so he could look up initially, and the commander would stand back. And we got used to doing this, you see. And he stood in the centre of the lorry platform, and he would guide the driver so that the two tracks corresponded with the two ramps. And then he would say, right, you would come on. And of course, a tank driver has to be trained. When he goes over an obstacle, he has to be able to drive up it, balance on it, and lower himself over and not drive over. So if you drive over an obstacle, like a bump, and you come down with a wallop the other side, then there's chaos reigns inside the vehicle as regards the turret, you see. So a driver knows with his revs what revs are required to drive up on the point of balance and then lower himself over under control, you see. Well, on these mocked up trials,